everybody. Welcome back into Mining Stock Daily. This is our week's long form episode. We have three guests and conversations to share with you today. First, we're going to air the second segment of my conversation with Warren Irwin. We previously talked a lot about the kind of sentiment in junior mining and speculation earlier. That aired on Wednesday. But the second segment, we're going to kind of open up his thoughts on kind of the status of the markets and shorting, what this whole GameStop frenzy really showed us this week. Really great conversation. I even asked Warren to give me an example. Sometimes he's been caught in a short squeeze. So interesting conversation with Warren Irwin. We then go into a conversation with Luke Alexander, who's the CEO of Nucor Gold, to get a corporate update from the latest drill results from Enchi in Ghana. And then we welcome our friend Matt Geiger back into the studio for a discussion on his thoughts on where we are in the precious metals market, given this big decline we saw yesterday, big sell-off in gold, and really kind of his cautionary tale of how to proceed. So three great conversations. Hope you can like and share the conversations on your social media with your family and friends, and also hit that review button if you could. Leave us a note of anything we're doing right, anything we can do better. Just let us know. Special thanks to our sponsors, Integra Resources, Western Copper and Gold, Corvus Gold, and Rio 2. Thank you so much for your continued support of the podcast. Couldn't do it without you. All right, we're going to jump into it. Long episode today. Let's welcome back Warren Irwin. Hey, we are back here with our second segment of our in-depth interview with Warren Irwin, a longtime well-known resource speculator. We chatted in really for about 30 minutes with Warren earlier this week about his positions and how he's positioning himself for a couple commodities such as uranium. We talked some gold stocks. We talked some frenzies into the equities markets. Now, we're going to turn the chapter a little bit here, Warren, and chat with you about really the what has been the big story, not only in markets, but really in all of the world almost, is this big run that we've seen from the likes of Robinhood, the short squeeze on GameStop, other equities. We tried to see a short squeeze in silver. It's just been, you know, I think in hindsight, one of the pros of this is a lot of people know about the market more than they did, you know, maybe a couple of weeks ago. I guess that's a positive news. But on the bad news is we see a lot of the ugliness as well.
Yeah. Yep. No, we're seeing a lot of things that a lot of people are learning the lessons that I learned decades ago.
Okay. Well, we're going to talk about some of those lessons. You know, looking back in the last couple of weeks, if we just use GameStop as the proxy here, because that's what everybody else is doing. In fact, we are recording this Wednesday afternoon. GameStop has come down to $100 a share, up from its highs of $500 in just a short few days. We kind of figured this was what was going to happen. But what's your thoughts here? What we saw in the last couple of weeks, what was your reaction to all this?
No, it's just really what happens when you could direct a whole bunch of capital to a very, very tight situation and things like this happen. That's exactly right. They nailed their target exactly right, which was a heavily shorted stock. And having been short myself, and I've learned over the years too, I know what it's like to have something run in my face. I'll give you an example. I was short Briex at the bottom, and I'm waiting to cover it pennies, right? And sure enough, I had one clown came out with a rumor that the mining company was looking at buying Briex. Was their CFO their CEO just resigned because he was involved in a fraud, trying to tell the world that Briex wasn't a fraud, and the stock tripled or quadrupled and right in my face. So I know the feeling of that. It's not a pleasant one. I was right in the end, and I had the money to keep myself in the trade. But when you get these massive runs, it's just a matter of liquidity. When you are offside on a short, you just keep having to put up more cash and more cash and more cash, and that could totally and completely blow you up if you continue to meet those margin requirements. So at some point, especially in a big run like GameStop, you've basically got to cry uncle at some point. And these Robin Hooders, they picked a very, very unique situation. It's just like your doctor, you know, sticking their thumb right in a point on your body where all your tension is, and it just lights you right up. Well, that's exactly what they found. They found the weakest point and jammed their thumb there, and they made a lot of people feel a lot of pain. And I felt that to a smaller extent, but I would hate to be have been those hedge funds caught offside in that short. It wouldn't have been pleasant.
Do you think this attention and this move by those Reddit traders and the Robin Hooders, you know, how justified were they to go after it? You know, is it, do you think they kind of unveiled the curtain here to show how the system really works when an equity could be short by 140% at one time?
Yeah, no, it's pretty outrageous for that to happen. You're seeing that throughout the financial markets. It's pretty ridiculous. Like, for instance, in the last, in 08, 09, I'd see $100 million bond deals with billions of dollars of credit default swaps based off it. So you really have to be careful. There's some of these new financial instruments are pretty dangerous. And with shorting's been around a very, very long time. So, but this over-shorting, I'm pretty sure it's not allowed here in Canada, and I'm not sure to what extent it's legal in the U.S., but that is, frankly, completely and totally outrageous for that to happen. And for the Reddit guys to go after the hedge funds on that, it's totally fair game. They're big boys. And you made them lose a ton of money. Well, they're trying to make you lose a ton of money. That's the way the financial markets are. There's a lot of competition out there. So I think it's completely fair game that they ganged up on the hedge funds, found that one of the stocks they were most exposed to, and made them feel a ton of pain. And to the extent that they made tens of millions of dollars on them, good for them. The question, of course, is how many people are going to wear this trade at the end of the day? Because I think the fundamentals will come true at the end of the fundamentals will bear out at the end of this process. And I hope too many retail investors don't get blown up on this by being long it at 500 and riding it right down to zero.
Do you think it was a fair game for the brokerages such as Robinhood to come out and put a limit on how many shares that they could buy of equities like GameStop, and or maybe could only issue sell orders, and really just put some hard regulation and rules behind it in reaction to all this?
Well, you know, that's going to be investigated, I'm sure. But so I can only speculate. And near as I could tell, based on my rational speculation, I think Robin Hood was probably having a number of capital requirements issues themselves. And rather than tell the world that they've got these capital requirement issues, they just did what, and you'll notice a number of other online trading houses also did the same thing. So I think they were just short on capital and dealing with these issues. And I know, like, I've had margin calls myself in the past from big banks and stuff. And, you know, the people you're financing your companies, your business with, if you get too concentrated in the name, they get very antsy. And I'm not sure what went on behind the scenes, but I'm pretty sure what really happened was they were under tremendous financial pressure from the people they settle with to... and they were concerned over the concentration they had in specific names. And I think that's a reason not only Robinhood did it, but a number of other online brokerages did it too, because to say that in one or 2 days, you know, half a dozen or more of these online trading houses all had the great idea to jump into the same conspiracy, I think that's a tiny bit of a stretch. And but, you know, that's just my speculation. I think everything will become clear in the investigation, and I hope my speculation is correct, because then that's there would be no wrongdoing in what I suggested may have happened. But I can't say for sure that that's indeed what happened, though.
It is refreshing to hear you come out and be honest and say you've been caught in a squeeze before. You know, give us the other side of this. You know, if you're on the side of the wrong side of a short squeeze, you know, what's going through your mind? What are the actions you need to do to really protect your capital and your fund?
Well, I'll give you one example. In 08, my hedge fund was 75% cash. I had about 25% that I couldn't liquidate super quickly, but I was concerned. So I went short General Electric, Harley Davidson, and Morgan Stanley. So I'm short those three names. And then one day the U.S. government steps up and says, we're banning the short sale of financials. Well, you know, I kind of feel like those Robin Hood clients, in that all of a sudden something I thought never thought in a million years could ever happen. The U.S. government stepping in and banning me from shorting Morgan Stanley. Are you kidding me? Morgan Stanley was, I forget the exact numbers, but they were leveraged 60 to 1, and the financial system was cratering. Of course, Morgan Stanley was going under, but they jammed me. So what do I do? I could have whined and complained and done whatever else I could have done. But instead I said, I'm covering as fast as I can. So I covered as fast as I can. How did the U.S. government jam me on my short with GE? Well, they said, well, we're going to be the buyer. Well, GE, they had mismatched their short-term versus long-term liabilities. They couldn't roll their commercial paper. So they were going to hit the wall liquidity-wise. And who would ever lend them money in the bottom of the market in 08? Well, U.S. government stepped in and said, well, we're going to be providing liquidity to the commercial paper market. Well, that saved GE from going bankrupt. So they've just saved GE from going bankrupt. They saved Morgan Stanley from going bankrupt. I'm short all these names. And Harley Davidson, I was going, well, the typical buyer of a Harley Davidson would be subprime a buyer. Well, that subprime market is completely dried up. Nobody's buying subprime loans. Well, sure enough, U.S. government stepped in to create some facilities to keep the subprime loan market liquid. So I got jammed that one day or so that all those restrictions came out with all three of my shorts, and I had to rush and cover. But my all-time favorite getting jammed in a short was early in my career, I was a credit analyst with the Bank of Nova Scotia in their fixed income department. So I knew when companies were going bankrupt. I was pretty good at it. So there's a company called Nova Chemical, and it was without a doubt going bankrupt. And I was short the stock, waiting for it to go into liquidation, and just sitting tight. Well, sure enough, just before it declares bankruptcy, it gets bought out by the Abu Dhabi Investment Authority at 5 times the market price. So I took a nice little kick in the pants at that point, which was not too much fun. To be short, you work out the math. You know, you're short $1 million, and next thing you know, you're short $5 million worth of stock. Well, that's not good. So I lost millions on that one, and it was something I could never believe would have ever happened, that somebody who wanted some of Nova's assets wouldn't just wait another few more weeks and buy the assets from the liquidator. So obviously they had their reasons for it. Perhaps they felt that under a liquidation scenario, they may not be first out of the box as far as being able to buy the assets they wanted. So they'd rather pay up before the company went bankrupt rather than to buy it from the receiver. So that's another one I got hurt on. And furthermore, on that whole Briex situation, when I had the market run against me with this rumor that was in the market that the CEO of the acquiring company had resigned, I immediately just put a phone call into the CFO of the company that was doing that, and then they basically confirmed to me that that rumor was false. And once I made sure that everybody knew that that rumor was false and that they had any questions, they could phone up the CFO to confirm it, that took the pressure off that short, and I eventually covered it 6 cents on that short. But shorting is quite a hairy thing to be doing, and again, I'd hate to be Melvin Capital the last few weeks, that's for sure.
I mean, you kind of mentioned, I mean, there's some cons to shorting, obviously, but can you spend, you know, a quick minute or two, what are the pros to shorting?
Okay, well, the pros. Yeah, well, I take a different view of shorting than a lot of people, but what, because I have a credit background, so I try only short companies that are going bankrupt. And, of course, the issue there is you can make a pile of money. I've watched, and even sometimes, too, when you create, if you're able to have some sort of call option in a company and you're able to create a short position against that, that's the ideal situation to be in also, because if it does run away against you, you could use the call options to protect yourself from the downside. But generally, I focus on bankruptcy scenarios, and I've made a bunch of money during the last 30 years, both when I was at Deutsche Bank and when I was at my my own firm here last 22 years, by just basically just doing standard blocking and tackling, doing credit analysis, realizing that this company is not going to make it. And, you know, I've been short Air Canada a number of times it went bankrupt, Nortel a number of times it went bankrupt, Loewen Group when it went bankrupt. It just goes, you know, it goes on and on. But those are the ones I prefer to play. Although I do remember an example. I knew some friends who had some convertible preferred shares, and they didn't think the company was, you know, going to do super well long term, and they shorted the stock using the convertible's function of the preferred share as protection, and they made an absolute fortune on a mining company. The stock, I believe, went from like $70 down to like $20. They made a fortune. Yeah.
But part of me, like, kind of I've been digesting all this in the last couple of weeks, is kind of figuring out where we're at in history. It almost seems that we have a lot more people participating in the markets now, but that trading activity has changed. It seems like more people are into these short, big gains, playing the options market, getting in, getting out as quickly as possible, then moving on to the next play, as opposed to putting money into the markets to help companies build and get bigger, long-term investing. And on the side of that, we also communicate differently. We're using the internet, things like Reddit and Twitter, another type of chat rooms. I mean, there's God knows how many trading groups are out there using other ways to communicate and send trade ideas and information. You know, what do you think about, like, this momentum trade versus long-term holding? I mean, does this forever change the way we put capital to use?
You know, I've thought about that in a number of issues. Another issue along those lines is the whole issue of passive money, right? Yeah. But everything goes in cycle, right? And I've seen this in so many times in my business. I've seen, for instance, when risk arbitrage hedge funds do really, really well, they do really, really well for a while, then too much capital goes into that sector, and then the returns they earn start to drop. And then somebody else who's been starved of capital earns really, really good returns, and then money is thrown at that sector. So what happens is people will do whatever makes them money. So right now, if people believe that short-term trading is something that will make them money, they'll be jumping all over that. And then eventually, when it doesn't, because too many people are following the same trades and there's no money to be made, then there'll be somebody they'll get wind of, like, let's say, like myself, where I'm buying all these high-quality commodity names that are super cheap. And they'll say, well, you know, Warren with his Rosso hedge fund, he was up, you know, he's up 50% last year. Man, let's jump into the resource market. And they'll be chasing the resource market for a while. So capital is quite mobile, and it won't stay in places too long where they're not earning a return. So if they're making some good dough here, you know, short-term trading, they'll do that. But eventually, you know, the opportunities will get fewer and far between, and then there'll be some new thing. It's just like, you know, back, if you read the stories of the gold rushes back in the 1800s, well, you know, you find gold in California. Well, you run into California. Well, then it's up, found up in the Yukon. All the gold miners run to the Yukon. Next thing you know, they're running to Alaska. Well, they're running around the world looking for the next big thing. So I think there's a lot of that going on. And as far as capital is very fluid. Capital will go to places where money is to be made. And if they're sitting in places where money's not being made, it's not very patient. So it's very much self-correcting as far as, I guess, the short answer. So we'll see what happens.
Well, what also is astonishing, and I kind of mentioned this earlier, is how the technologies are being used now to really ramp up this frenzy into the options market. And we've also seen how it was communicated throughout Reddit with GameStop and the short squeeze, and even the silver squeeze, which was seemed very short-lived. You know, in reading about the history of BREX, we kept on reading about how BREX was using their website at the time, which was such a novel idea because the internet was still young in the mid-90s, early 90s. But it really allowed them to really stay in touch with their investors and people watching their company. You know, as we talk about the technology, the communications technology, as it pertains to the equities market and creating this frenzy, is that just another thing to be watching here to know maybe when the top is in?
Well, you know, it's interesting. BREX was probably the first example of a stock that's traded where it had an active online chat room. Believe it or not, it was so early in the days. It was just, everything was pretty Stone Age, and it had a chat session called on, believe it or not, Silicon Investors. Somebody had started a chat session there, and chat sessions and emails and all that stuff was pretty darn new in the, you know, the early to mid 90s. But the same stuff was going on back then is going on today. You know, chat rooms were going on, in fact, what's interesting is just the other day, probably 6 months ago, I went back and checked on Silicon Investor, and believe it or not, they have left all the chats from 1993, 94, 95, 96, all about BREX. So any financial historian out there who says, well, let's just see what happened out there, and you'll go back there and you'll see guys with the names of, Big Dude, that was me, and then there was Mike Sloan, and there was a guy named Drumbeat. And I got, you know, you go back to those guys. And if you want to see what it's like to be in a frenzy, it's all there for everyone to read and everybody to see exactly how everybody talked and the greed versus fear and the rumor mill and what was happening then. Because frankly, the BREX days made this little excitement over GameStop seemed like nothing really. Like there was so much intrigue with BREX with respect to being at the time a $5.6 billion fraud. So it was pretty big. You know, 25 years ago, $5.6 billion was a lot of money. But there's a lot of things being pioneered there, you know, with chat sessions, multiple billion-dollar wins. And back then, $5.6 billion was worth a lot more than it was today. And it was fascinating to see how that happens. And it's all there for anybody who has the time and effort to go in and read the fear, the panic, the greed, and what people were thinking. And I'm sure if you looked at the chat rooms today, many of the exact same things will happen.
The emotions don't change. The emotions are still there.
Yeah.
The equity changes.
But do you know what happened there, which is interesting, is following the blow up of BREX, it blew up a lot of retail investors, and the mining industry did not see retail investors in any great way from about 1996, 97 timeframe when BREX blew up till about the early 2000s. It was about a 5-year hiatus where retail investors did not touch the resource sector because of BREX. So, and it's probably not much different than back in the crash of 2000 of the NASDAQ. The NASDAQ was down 80, 90%. A lot of retail investors got laid out. I bet you they took a bit of a tech holiday of a few years before they were willing to get back into it again. But that's often what happens sometimes when retail gets into a sector. I've seen it happen a few times. They get overly enthusiastic, overly convinced of their capabilities and their knowledge, and they go and blow themselves up, and then they stay away from the market for a while.
You fear that could potentially happen here in the general equities after something like this squeeze on GameStop?
Yeah, well, just take a look at the Tesla believers, right? Like, I've driven Teslas. I don't think they're that great. And I think there are going to be a lot of really incredible electric vehicles in the next number of years. And, you know, so we'll see what happens. Like, there's a lot of froth in the market right now, and retail is pretty confident that they know what they're doing. So that overconfidence will, whenever anybody is overconfident in the market has a way of teaching you a lesson.
Warren, I just want to leave you with one final question. It's really a holistic wrap here of this discussion that we've had over the last couple of segments. And I'm just kind of curious, you know, you've always been an outspoken gentleman. You've always been candid with your opinions. But with the recent activities in the last couple of weeks we've seen in the general equities and the big markets, you know, why are you coming out now and speaking out about all this? You know, what's the reason?
Well, there's a reason. It's outlined in an article I wrote a few years back. And if you Google my name, Warren Irwin and Brex, BREX, there's an article I wrote that's about 4 pages long for CEO.ca. And basically what I said in that article was the reason for me coming out and sharing my stories about Brex and sharing my stories about the markets and just the lessons I've learned. And the reason for that is my ass was saved by somebody not unlike myself who had the time to take me aside and tell me how the world really worked. And the guy's name was Dale Hendrick. I believe he died last year or the year before. Very dear fellow. And he taught me a lot of things. He told me stories that as a naive idiot investor when I first started, I couldn't believe. They were too fascinating. He told me about the mining industry and how people were scammed and how people showed up dead and how people were taking kickbacks and the level of dishonesty and deceit in the mining business and why he believed Brex was a fraud. And he was the first guy who kind of got me thinking a little differently. And I owe a debt of gratitude to him. So my way of paying back is to share some of the lessons I've learned, to save one or two retail investors from blowing themselves up completely financially in the future.
Warren, appreciate your time. It's been a very heartfelt conversation and very timely. I thank you so much for kind of opening up and giving your thoughts to myself and the listeners of Mining Stock Daily.
Oh, you're very welcome, Trevor. Really enjoyed the conversation. Thank you.
Yeah, appreciate it. We'll look forward to catching up with you hopefully later this year and see how this all pans out. But until then, stay healthy, stay safe, and have yourself a great winter. We're in here in our second segment of our Friday morning long-form interview, long-form episode here, and happy to welcome back the CEO of Nucor Gold, Mr. Luke Alexander. Nucor trades on the TSX Venture with the symbol NCAU. Luke, pleasure to have you back on. How have you been?
Yeah, I've been doing really well, thanks. And thanks for having me on.
I really wanted to just take some time, get a little catch up on the latest round of drill results you've had. You've gone into this drilling campaign aiming to get 58,000 meters done. You're well on your way. But you continue to show continuity throughout the project, throughout your targets that you're hitting. The oxide goal continues to be very favorable as you continue to build ounces into the Enchi project in Ghana. But really what's most notable is you've been able to fill some of these gaps.
Yeah, absolutely. And thanks for bringing that up. We put out a couple of press releases in January. And something that we were talking about a lot at the end of last year was a couple of, half kilometer to kilometer size gap areas within two of our main resources, Boeing and Siyum. So we put out a press release on January 7th. Boeing had about 1 kilometer gap within the two main pits, and we expected it to be mineralized, and those results that we put out on January 7th show that it's mineralized in between those pits, and our view is that over time that will become one larger pit. So that was all step out drilling, and we think will add to our overall resource. Similarly at Siyum, which is the other large resource area, about 535,000 ounces at Siyum, about 530,000 ounces at Boeing. There was about a half kilometer gap area there where we stepped out and drilled right through that whole gap. And again, as we expected, it's fully mineralized. And over time, we expect that that will just become one large pit between those two. So we were really pleased with those results and expect them to continue to add to our overall resource.
How many drill holes do you expect to kind of put into this gap and continue to build that out?
So for now, we've kind of stepped out and we're comfortable with the drilling that's been done there. If you look at in terms of number of holes, in 2020, we drilled 112 holes, and we've now released all of those, including those drill results in the gap zone that I talked. And in total, we're expecting to drill about 400 holes. So we've now released results from about 18,000 meters of the total 58,000 meter program. So call it about 30% of the overall drilling's now been released to the market.
You did have success doing some extension drilling up at a target called, and I'm sorry if I mispronounced this, Kwachikrom. Did I pronounce that right?
Kwachikrom, yeah.
Kwachikrom, okay. Obviously, again, extending more mineralization, finding more ounces in the project. I assume this will continue to be a target to drill out and explore some more in the future.
Yeah, absolutely. So if you look at that 112 holes or 18,000 meters that we drilled in 2020 and that we've now released, about 70-75% of it was resource expansion drilling at our existing resource areas, so Boeing, Siyum, and Niam. Kwachikrom, what you're asking about, that's an area that we historically drilled. We did two follow-up drill campaigns in 2020, nine holes each. End of January, we released the second set of nine holes at Kwachikrom. We remain very encouraged by the results that we've had there. We've now proven about 600 meter mineralized area, which sits within a 2.5 kilometer long anomaly. We expect that Kwachikrom will become our next resource area, and we will continue to drill there in the first half of 2021. So yeah, we've been very pleased with the results there. And as we've kind of talked about, we've got multiple targets across the property, and this is how we continue to de-risk it by follow-up drilling and ultimately looking to move these things towards additional resource areas, which will obviously add to our overall resource across the property.
Do you feel like you will have enough drilling done by the time this is all said and done in the first half of the year to get that resource on Kwachikrom?
Yes. Yeah. And that's why I'm kind of starting to talk about it with the additional results that we've got. We're starting to get confidence that that we will be able to turn that into a resource over time.
Okay, and just for a reminder for people listening and maybe who are new to the story, can you give us a rundown of where that resource currently stands on the entire Enchi project?
Yep, so it currently sits at 1.22 million ounces. That's spread across three deposits, Boeing and Siyum, which I talked about, which both sit at about 530,000 ounces. And then Niam. Interestingly, Niam is just north of Kwachikrom, about 5 kilometers. And it looks like it's actually an extension. Kwachikrom is an extension of Niam. So the 1.2 million ounce sits within those three, and hopefully we'll add Kwachikrom to that over time. And then one of the key things that while talking about the resource is that the bulk or 95% of that resource sits in within the oxide and transitional zones. And what's important about that is it means it lends itself to heap leach mining. Heap leach mining is a much less capital intensive way of mining, and ultimately means that you typically get better NPVs and IRRs for your projects given its lower capital. So It's one of the real differentiators for our project is we've only drilled down to about an average of 50 to 60 meters. So we've really been focused on that oxide zone across our property. And we think that that's, you know, that's a real differentiator with the 1.2 million ounce resource that we currently have.
Walk us through kind of what the strategy is for 2021. There was a PEA done on the project about 5-6 years ago. Maybe doesn't hold the same breadth as not only what the drilling is starting to show, but also metals prices are completely different. You know, we're obviously going to see a new mineral resource at Krachy Krum. Would you update that PEA by the end of the year, or is that maybe not something you're considering?
Yeah, no, we're actually in the process of updating the PEA. So you referred to the 2015 PEA, and I mean, it can be found on our website if people are interested in having a closer look. But that PEA included a 712,000 ounce in-pit resource. We've now grown that to 1.22 million ounce in-pit resource. And as you highlighted, the gold environment's definitely changed. And if you look at a lot of the recent studies that have come out there, they're obviously using higher gold prices. So our view and the reason why we're targeting to have an updated PEA released by the beginning of Q2 this year, so we'll, you know, call it a couple months from now, is that we think we will further underpin the value of the company for our shareholders by getting, you know, those additional ounces included in an updated PEA. So we're excited to get that completed.
So you did mention that majority of the current resource sits in this oxide mineralization. One of the things that always intrigued me about the project and the reason I had become a shareholder is because I'm very excited about what the potential underneath that oxide. We're seeing Kinross mine sulfides, very similar mineralization to the north of Enchi. Talk about when do you start to maybe strategically start doing these deeper holes and going after some sulfide mineralization?
So we actually started in December. So I guess just taking a half step back, if you look at where we're located, we're situated on the Sefwi Bibiani Belt in Ghana. It's one of two prolific belts in country. Running from the north of the belt to the south, you've got the Bibiani Shear, which runs through there. You referred to Kinross's Chirano mine. That Bibiani Shears runs to the right to the east of Chirano and then comes down directly to the west of us. So we're 50 kilometers to the south of that Chirano mine. And what you see in these greenstone-hosted deposits, and there's a very good longitudinal section at the back of our presentation if people are interested in looking in more detail. What you see with these greenstone-hosted deposits is where they start to increase in grade and start to double, triple, and quadruple in size is when you start getting below the oxides and into the sulfides. So for the first time ever, we're starting to drill some deep holes on the project. As I highlighted earlier, the average depth to date is down to about 50 or 60 meters. So we've really been focused on those oxides. The deepest holes only down to about 175 meters. So we're starting to drill some holes down to 250 to 350 meters and looking to start expanding the pits at depth and also looking to make some higher grade discoveries as we do drill deeper. The first rig started turning in December, so we're starting to drill some deeper holes below Boeing. We've got a second diamond rig showing up, which will start drilling some holes below Seum, and then we'll have a third diamond rig show up as well. So we are allocating a portion of that 58,000 meter to start testing some of these deeper opportunities across our project, and it's something that we're very excited about as well.
Lots of drilling taking place. I'm sure lots of results going to be hitting the pipeline here in the next coming weeks, if not sooner. So we'll probably be catching up with you once again before the end of the month, Luke.
Thanks a lot, Trevor, and thanks everyone for listening in.
That's Luke Alexander, CEO of Nucor Gold. They trade on the TSX Venture with NCAU and on the OTCQX with NCAUF. Hey, welcome into Mining Stock Daily. This is Trevor Hall, and we have some market commentary today with, well, on any other given day would be a good friend, but today, since it's the London Derby and my Chelsea Blues are taking on our arch rival, Tottenham Hotspur, and I just happened to be talking to, I think you might be the only Tottenham fan who I consider a friend and a good colleague, Matt Geiger from MJG Capital. Matt, I promise you I will try to keep the banter to a minimum today. We are less than an hour away from kickoff in the toilet bowl that is the new Spurs stadium. But you knew it was coming. You knew it was coming.
Yeah, I sensed it wasn't a coincidence that you had me on today, but it's always great to be back on the program.
So. You thought we were going to talk about mining. Yeah, all right.
I did, but
had you fooled. No. Hey, how are you, Matt?
I am doing all right. It's good to be back on with you and your listeners. I was able to get the fund's investor letter sent early last week, so I've kind of emerged from the digital dungeon I've been occupying for the past couple of weeks and resurfaced for air. And it's good to catch up with folks like yourself. The year started off on a good foot.
Yeah, we do love having you on, Matt, and so we got a lot to talk about. And obviously, let's hit it from the top here and just kind of talk about this move in precious metals. I mean, today it's just, I mean, no other way to put it. It's ugly out there. Gold coming down, future gold down to 1792. That is a massive loss. Oh, God, where are we at now? It's down over 2%. Silver. You know, still kind of in this range coming down from that top that we saw that, you know, the fake out in the short squeeze earlier this week. You know, given what you're seeing in the precious metals market and the metals specifically, are you in panic mode or are you just kind of hanging out and realize this was probably going to end up happening anyways?
Yeah, far from panic mode. I think you at the moment have to look at the two metals separately. I will say, and it's easy to say in hindsight, but I was quite skeptical that this Reddit squeeze, as interesting as it was to follow, and it looks like some folks out there, whether it was Redditors or not, you know, did their darnest to push this narrative. But after a couple of days of buying, we've seen it fall flat on its face. And there's a clear, distinct difference between cornering, you know, a single $1 billion stock. You know, I think GameStop's market cap was a billion and a half when the squeeze really started with a high short interest versus taking on an entire, you know, metal where the physical metal alone, I think, is at $30 billion. And then you add on all the equities. There's just so many different vehicles that you can play it so that, you know, buying interest was diluted over quite a few names. But I will say, and you mentioned it, silver did break above that $26 key technical level. Try not to get too sucked into the technicals as an investor, but I think that's pretty well established. And so far it's held it. So if that's kind of the lone takeaway from the Reddit silver squeeze, then as longer term silver investors, I think that's actually not a bad place to be. Gold is more challenging at the moment. It's certainly being viewed as a risk off asset. And judging by the behavior we're seeing all across the market, both within our niche of the junior resource market and then also elsewhere, it's clear that we're not in a risk-off period. This is very much a risk-on period. FOMO is right. Folks are greedy. I mean, just think of the behavior that we're seeing in the Reddit chat room, for instance. And I think it's cool. I'm all for it. These are individual investors' rights to do this. But this is the kind of key example of greedy speculative behavior. This is not the type of activity we were seeing in March. Just think back to March 2020. There were no Reddit chat rooms, right, with short squeezes going on. So I don't want to read too much into this single event, but there's certainly quite a few anecdotes that have popped up over the past couple months that you know, make it pretty clear that if you believe the market swings from a pendulum from fear to greed, we are certainly on the greed side.
There's a lot going on. I mean, the dollar continues to surge this week. The 10-year bond continues to move higher, currently at 1.14 right now as we speak. The major markets in the U.S., I mean, it's almost inevitable, I think, right now. The SPY ETF is going to create a new all-time high here. It's just literally 50 cents away from reaching that all-time high, which was just made a couple days ago. So it just appears to be this disconnect here between the commodities market and the general market right now. And I'm talking short term, like in the last few days or weeks even. Explain this paradox, what you're seeing here between the broader commodity cycle and the broader market cycle.
Sure. Well, I'll comment less on kind of the behavior we've seen in the past few days. I think this is more of a hangover from the silver excitement earlier this week. And, you know, JP Morgan kind of pulled the rug out from miners earlier this week as well, with kind of a downgrade on the sector. So I'm not reading too much into the short-term fluctuations. I will say, if you're thinking from a longer-term perspective, though, we are in this interesting paradox, especially for folks like us that are, you know, very, very much exposed to the mining sector, and particularly the junior mining sector. Even though we've had a really good run here, both from the, you know, the March 2020 bottom, but also since, you know, gold broke out in spring of 2019, it's been a good year or two or three of performance, especially for those of us that were around in 2015. It's actually been a good five-year period here. But if you look at the general indicators of where we are broadly, natural resources in the commodity sector is still extremely cheap historically relative to most all other asset classes. And, you know, there are plenty of different indicators that you can look at, but one of the most commonly used, and I think it's a fair one to use, at least for a back of an envelope sense of where we're at, is the GSCI to S&P indicator, even though the GSCI is maybe a little overly weighted towards energy. But the point remains that if you look over the past 50 years, there's only been two other periods where we've been remotely this cheap relative to the broader equity market. And you know, if you go back and look at the chart, we're at about 1.5 at the moment, and we've kind of had three big commodity peaks in the past 50 years, and usually you see that ratio get up to the 6, 7, 8 range. So if you're judging with broad strokes, we're still quite early here, and I feel optimistic for the coming 3, 4, 5, even this coming decade. That said, that's juxtaposed against my concern for where we are with the broader market. And I think that there's a distinct possibility that we see another March 2020-like episode in the somewhat near future here. I don't want to be heroic and call a top. Market timing is not my thing. But it seems like we're ripe for that. And even though it's at no fault of the mining industry of its own, I think actually the industry's done a pretty good job here. In recent years, at least, allocating capital and doing their best to stay lean and create shareholder value. If there's that big broad sell-off like we saw in March, just as we experienced then, we are going to get hit square on the jaw. And I think there's risks, even though we've had a very good run here, for in short term, mining speculators' portfolios could fall 40 to 50% in short order, just like they did in March of last year. So I think it's incumbent on investors to kind of embrace this possibility and prepare themselves mentally and maybe do some tinkering on the margins of their portfolios to make sure that they're positioned for if slash when this will happen.
So do you think is it safe to say that another market crash like we saw in March, can we call it a crash? I mean, because that would be an anomaly, right? We typically don't see a crash. Two crashes that close together, you know, within a year of each other, right?
True. I mean,
it'd be an anomaly. I'm not saying it can't happen.
I'd say if you look back to kind of the beginning of this broader monetary cycle, to where Volcker jacked up interest rates in the past or in the early 80s, we've gone steadily down from, you know, 18, 19, 20% rates to now, you know, basically zero at present day. And so, yes, over that 40-year period, over that paradigm, there have not been these kind of short crashes in succession. Usually you'll get the big drop and then 5 to 10, 15 years. In this case, it's been close to 13 years now of the market running since the last crash, ignoring the flash crash in March here. But I will say, there are periods in history where that absolutely is the case, and the market can get very choppy. And I mean, look at the 1930s. I'm not suggesting that we're going into a 1930s like period here. I think it's a possibility. But you think of that as a very depressed decade. If you go back and actually look at the markets, there are 3-4 periods over that decade where stocks rallied extremely sharply based off of government policy. And you had rallies of 60-70% in the market in a matter of months or a year. So of course the decade as a whole was viewed rightly in history as a depressed one, but there were period flashes of excitement as well. So I wouldn't rule out the possibility that we see another one of these in somewhat short order. The reason I'm feeling a little bit more confident that it's at least coming here soon, and I'll point back to Jeremy Grantham. I think any of your listeners, if they haven't yet, they should go to GMO's website, read his most recent white paper, which he put out at the beginning of January. And if your listeners want to watch a video as well, he did a Bloomberg interview just a week and a half ago. But he's made a career studying bubbles, and I hold his opinion in very high esteem. And his point is that, yes, the broader stock market's been overvalued for quite some time. And that's been clear to a lot of value investors and market participants. Just because something's overvalued numerically doesn't mean it's inherently going to revert to the mean tomorrow. And that's what some people can overlook. That's why these cycles can last longer than those that are more pessimistic can imagine. But what we're seeing different now, this is the key point, is that acceleration, that euphoria that you will often see towards the very tail end of these bubbles. And I think that can't be disputed. He defines acceleration from his studies as markets going up over 60% over, I think, of 18-month period, if I'm not mistaken. And just since March, we've seen NASDAQ up 90%. We've seen the S&P and Dow up over that 60% level. And we're finally seeing the retail speculation come into play, which has been absent for basically the past 12 or 13 years. So it just seems like the different things that you generally see falling into place towards the top of cycles are starting to appear. It doesn't mean that, you know, there's going to be a massive red on our screen tomorrow, but it's definitely causing me caution as I look forward to the next 3 or 6 months. Absolutely.
Yeah. Let me ask you about this generational move in the retail side. I mean, you and I are young guys. I mean, we see eye to eye on a lot of things, a generational, you know, the way we carry this generation, like we, you know, is the way how we kind of go about our trading and our investing. And I feel like it's safe to say that because I've known you for a little while and you and I have had many conversations off mic. So I'm just kind of curious, the way this generation is trading is not the way the system was set up to be. It's almost in and out quick, you know, high flying stocks, get some quick returns, play the options market, get out, move on to the next thing, where there's not this invest in company for a long periods of holding to help that company grow and build. And are we to the point to where even that idea of long-term investing, specifically for our generation, is just an afterthought?
It's a great question. Yeah, and kind of more on the philosophical side of things. I will say that, yeah, there's great concern out there that, you know, value investing is a relic of the past. It does seem like everything nowadays is narrative driven and capital flow driven. And that seems to be the only thing that people are focusing on. And yeah, for the past 12, 13 years, maybe longer, it's worked pretty successfully. But I do believe that the pendulum will swing back towards value investing. It always does. But before I get to that, though, I will hypothesize that perhaps the reason why this narrative driven growth, you know, speculation that you mentioned that we're seeing that run rampant, especially amongst folks in our generation. Perhaps one of the reasons that's been working is that interest rates are extremely low. And kind of the major premise of value investing is that you're buying for good value a company's future discounted cash flows. And so companies that are pumping out cash today and have reasonable prospects for that to continue in the future, those are often good value investments. But the issue here is with interest rates extremely low, people are plugging in, you know, close to zero discount rates into their models. And so they're not valuing present term cash flow as highly as they would is if they're using a higher discount rate. So I do think the interest rate move we've seen from the Fed supports this this narrative-driven speculation that we see amongst our generation. But I don't think it can continue. And I mean, we'll see. But we've gone from over the past 40 years from 19-20% Volcker interest rates to now 0% with Mr. Powell. And it doesn't seem like there's a lot more runway for this move to play out. So I think we will see higher rates at some point. I'm not sure how we get there, but I think value investing will come back to the fore at some point here. And also, I think it's worth mentioning that value investing, especially in markets like these, will help preserve capital in major drawdowns. That's one of the benefits. If the market continues along its current trajectory, if you have a value-laden portfolio, your hope is that it plays catch-up to some of the growth names as people cycle into better value. But you also know in the back of your head, if we do see that next big panic, your names are obviously going to get hit on the chin, but won't be falling 60 or 70% like some of the hottest growth stocks will that we're seeing today.
Yeah. I mean, but can you blame people for taking some of this money that maybe they got from a stimulus check? In the last year, a lot of people have lost their job. They've closed down everything. A lot of businesses are closed down. Just going out and being an active member of society is almost frowned on. I mean, God, you live in San Francisco. Right. Like I hear horror stories about what's going on in San Francisco. You get this money, you see this dialogue online in the chat rooms of people going into the options market or buying GameStop and putting the squeeze on, running it up, and people thinking, well, I have this $1,400 check and they're devaluing the dollar. I can't do much with this $1,400. I need to make more of it. What else are they supposed to do? I mean, this is the beast that has been created. It's not their fault.
Right. Right. I'm sympathetic. As I said, I'm not against the Reddit phenomenon that we've been seeing. I'm watching and following along. I'm just concerned because I want these investors to be involved in the market longer term. I think it's in their best interest to do so. I just feel that if your first foray into the stock market is at kind of the tail end of a 12 to 13 year run, more likely than not, it's going to end in tears for the majority of the people that are jumping in full steam ahead. And I feel that could kind of poison their future. I mean, both financially, but also as investors going forward, they might just throw in the towel and not consider the stock market again for decades. Who knows? Could be a lost generation of retail investors.
Yeah, you don't want to be the person that bought GameStop at $450.
No, you don't.
No.
And there are quite a few folks that did.
Yep. Yeah. Okay, so let's get back to the metals complex here in mining. We did digress, but I mean, this is a conversation that you and I have been wanting to have regardless. So given all the information and thoughts and analysis you just shared over the last few minutes, how are you positioning your MJG fund now? And on top of that, what are some of the conversations you're having with companies that are in your fund?
Absolutely. So I'll touch on those in reverse order, if that's all right. In terms of kind of the advice for what it's worth that I'm sharing with our holdings, it's pretty simple. I am absolutely in the camp of take money if it is available right now. I think we've had a great run really across the junior resource sector here over the past, close to 12 months at this point. And I don't think now is the time to be greedy with dilution, which is funny for me to say, because I will readily admit that dilution is our number one enemy as investors in this sector. And I absolutely value teams that have that skin in the game and resist dilution with all costs. That said, in this market with kind of the uncertainty, I'm not convinced that 2021 is going to play out like 2020 did. Or at least the second two thirds of 2020 did. I'm saying take the money, and that can be accomplished a couple of ways. First would be for the company to accelerate in the money warrants if they're able to do so. And so we've had at least two companies in the past 60 days call in warrants using their acceleration clause. If companies don't have that acceleration clause, then they can also go to the warrant holders and offer an incentive to exercise early. And I think that would be something to consider in this time period. And if you don't have in the money warrants as a company, then, you know, consider going out and raising money through private placement. And, you know, from what I can see, you shouldn't have to offer anything more than a half warrant in this market environment. So it's, you can get pretty decent terms from a company and from an existing shareholder perspective. So I'm saying, hey, if you don't have enough working capital to get you through your next major catalyst, actually couple major catalysts, raise money. If you don't have, also calculate the bare minimum burn rate per month that you need to keep the lights on and to keep your properties in good standing. And even if you're spending well above that at the moment, which you probably should be to be pushing your project forward, think of what the worst case scenario is and make sure that if we go into a nuclear winter period here, you have 18 to 24 months of runway in the bank before you have to finance next. So that's kind of my simple advice for companies at the moment. And otherwise, I'm tracking their projects and decisions and management team decisions and making buy or sell decisions based off of whether they're achieving their goals and also where the company's valuation is relative to what I think fair value is. In terms of how I'm looking at the portfolio right now, we had a great 2020. I would say we have plenty of speculative names in the portfolio at the moment, where during that next drawdown, you know, 50 to 60% declines in the share price aren't out of the question by any means. These are companies that I still have conviction in. And their original thesis is still intact. So I'm willing to tolerate those drawdowns. But I think it's important for investors to kind of conceptualize how extreme that could be. In terms of, you know, new positions that we're adding, I'm trying to be very selective. The type of position that we'd add to the portfolio would fall into the value category, as you can surmise. Looking specifically at downside protection here for the foreseeable future. And I'm basically looking for new potential names that if we do have that next major market puke, we'll fall only 30, 40% versus the 60 to 70% that we see with some of these more speculative names. And a few of the signs that I'm looking for to you know, evaluate what is the level of downside protection. One of them is whether the company has a large cash and marketable security position relative to its market cap. Because that can often be a good indicator for what the floor would be in a worst case scenario. And, you know, we have companies in the portfolio currently like Sama Resources, where half of their market cap is covered by cash and marketable securities. Hell, we have a company called Golden Valley Mines in our portfolio where more than their entire market cap is covered by cash and marketable securities. So those are kind of investments that I'd be, if I can find similar opportunities out there, that's the kind of thing I'd be attracted to. You know, also looking at companies that are trading within touching distance of, say, their March 2020 low. You know, we have a few names in the portfolio currently that are only, you know, 30% away from that level, where we have other companies in the portfolio that have gone up 5, 6, in some cases 10x from where they were 12 months ago. So this is a very rough, you know, back of the envelope thing to look at. But if you still have conviction in the story and the people involved, you know, assuming that 52-week low and that we saw in March is kind of the sign of what we would see in another sell-off, you can kind of have an idea what downside is there. And then also just a couple other things, you know, companies that haven't had recent promotion campaigns, you can see that there's minimal speculative excitement built into the share price, names that you haven't seen thrown around and bandied about on, you know, mining Twitter and online. I think the quieter, the better from a promotion perspective. And then you can also look at whether there's been substantial recent buying from management and or whether the key players have significant skin in the game with a cost basis that's close to the current share price. Because there are plenty of well-incentivized management teams out there that have done a great job. And, you know, they're already up 5 or 6 or, again, 10x on their cost basis. There are other teams out there, though, that have credentials, that are honest, that have good assets that have been overlooked so far in this kind of speculative frenzy. And I think those are better, you know, horses to hitch your wagon to, just to be prudent here.
Man, I know with the fund, you are obviously representing a lot of individual investors in this one in this one portfolio, but we keep on talking about as individual speculators in this market, you have to take profits because it's just too risky.
Mm-hmm.
And you just mentioned you have positions in the portfolio that are up 5, 6, 7 times, if not more. And I also know you as an individual, you are a long-term holder. I don't know you taking profits very often. At least you haven't explained that to me. But I mean, why as a portfolio manager, in just kind of your thesis and why you invest and speculate in this, shouldn't you be taking profits as well to support your investors that are helping fund this portfolio?
Could you reframe that a little bit?
Yeah, sorry. I didn't ask that. I'm just kind of so I know you are a really you're a long time holder. You like to see things through.
Sure.
But also, we keep on talking like the junior resource market is so risky that if things do move up, you should be taking profits.
Correct.
As it goes, because it's so risky, you could see this down. You could see it get pushed down rather quickly, and all those profits just evaporate. But as a portfolio manager, and you representing a number of different individuals. That have put money into this portfolio. How often do you take profits? Because I know you as an individual, as the manager.
Correct.
Are real long time buy and hold.
Correct.
But we're also told as individual speculators, if these things move up, it's too risky to not take profits.
Okay. Yeah.
So how do you balance that?
Yeah. So the MJG fund is structured purely for long-term capital appreciation. So yeah, we're not an income fund by any means. Partners put money in and they wait 10 years for you know the process to play out, and then they receive the you know their check at the end of the day. That said, in select occasions, I do have the ability to waive the 10-year lockup. So that's my sole discretion. And you know a lot of these partners, especially the very earliest ones. Because I started so young, I started out of my sophomore year dorm room at the Wharton School at UPenn. You know, the original 7 partners are all friends and family. Like these are not folks where I'm trying to capture their money and nickel and dime them for indefinite periods. And so I'm very much upfront with my clients. You need to look at both the performance of the MJG fund, but in the context of your overall investment portfolio. And if you're getting to the point where it's, you know, 15-20% of your overall portfolio, even if you haven't lasted your full 10 years, I'm going to be supportive for you to take money off the table and rebalance. So I think that can be a good way to keep yourself honest as an investor and not try to call the top exactly, which is impossible to do. And so, you know, one way to take appropriate amounts of profits as an individual investor is, yeah, just look at the size of your resource-focused holdings relative to the whole. And maybe you've been on a huge run over the past 12 months here. Good for you. It might be at 15 or 20% of your overall portfolio. Probably shouldn't get much higher than that. If we have a couple good more months here and you look at your portfolio and you're at 23% resource exposure, well, hey, why not take a third off the table? Get it back down to 15%. That's still extremely, extremely healthy. Relative to your average investor out there. So I think you need to look at position or portfolio allocation as a way to take profit. But you also need to, and this is where it gets difficult, look on the individual micro level as well. So there are times where you should be taking money off the table because your resource portfolio as a whole is getting too big relative to your assets. There also should be times where you're selling individual stocks because they themselves have exceeded what is fair value. So you kind of want to keep an eye on both of those things. It's challenging. That's why you know speculating in this industry is not a part-time job. And unless you're willing to dedicate that 25 or 30 hours, hopefully much more per month, it's probably better to put the money in the hands of somebody else that's doing so.
Thanks for letting me ask you that question. I appreciate it.
Yeah, no problem.
I know it's a hard one to answer. okay. Appreciate your time. We got to wrap it up there because we got on about 10 minutes longer than originally thought we would. But I'll give you the last word. London Derby, Chelsea visits Tottenham. What's your score prediction? kickoff is in 25 minutes.
Dramatic 2-1 victory for Tottenham Hotspur. We score an easy goal. We score an easy early goal. We then hold that lead until the later stages of the game. Concede against Chelsea, as we always have. Everybody gets down on themselves. And then a miraculous late-minute goal, maybe from Lucas or Gareth Bale. 2-1 Spurs. That is my personal, professional opinion. What are you saying,
Three-two Chelsea. Pulisic gets the second goal. Timo Werner comes on, scores the game winner.
Wow. Super.
Totally redeems himself.
Timo the super sub. We will see.
All right. We'll continue the banter via text message, my friend.
Yes, wait. I'm going to be watching delayed, though. So, unfortunately, we're going to have to wait this evening.
All right. That's Matt Geiger from MJG Capital. Matt, have yourself a great weekend, my friend. Good to chat with you once again.
Yeah, it's been really fun. Thanks, Trevor.
The information presented should not be considered investment advice. Mining Stock Daily and its affiliates are not responsible for any loss arising from any investment decision in connection with the material presented herein. Please do your own research or speak with a licensed financial representative before making any investment decision.